Okay, so my name's Kevin Gunn from the University of Manchester, and today I'm talking to Graham Hayes from Aston University in Birmingham about the recent case of the Stansted 15, who were recently convicted under anti-terror charges after a protest about deportation in which they used direct action techniques to stop a runway at Stansted, with the result of cancelling a flight that contained seven asylum seeker deportees. So the trial's been going on for a long time, for 9 weeks, I believe. And Graham's been observing the whole of the trial as part of a wider project looking at disobedience, direct action, and trials of protesters. So thanks for coming along, Graham.
Yeah, pleasure.
So just want to start by asking you about the nature of the charges that these protesters are facing, because I believe it's a first. And I'm not sure people will be very familiar with this particular law.
Okay, so after the Lockerbie bombing in 1988, there was an international protocol called the Montreal Protocol. Which realized that lots of the international legislation around terrorism concerned only what happened to planes when they were on the ground. And of course, this happened to planes in midair. And so there was a new addition to the protocol which came in, which talked about the security of aerodromes and the security of safety of people at aerodromes or on aeroplanes. And so this was translated into British law in 1990 with the specific intent to put into UK law what this international terrorism statute was. So in March, on March 28th, 2017, a group of 15 activists cut through the fencing at Stansted Airport. Made their way 122 meters across a grassed area. It was dark, to a Titan Airways Boeing 767 flight, which was due to take 57 people from one of the UK's immigration detention centres to Nigeria. Four of them locked themselves around the nose wheel of the plane, and the remaining 11 constructed a tripod. One of the activists sat on top of the tripod, and the others all locked on around the base of the tripod. Although one activist was arrested within about 7 minutes as the police arrived. He hadn't locked on properly. And the others, it took a police specialist dispersal team 10 hours to release the others. They were arrested. The next day, they give statements in police stations across London, and they were charged with criminal damage and aggravated trespass. In July 2017, that charge was escalated to a breach of the 1990 Aviation and Maritime Securities Act. That's endangerment of an aerodrome or of persons, of the safety of persons at an aerodrome. That's the post-Lockerbie charge, and that charge has a maximum sentence of life imprisonment. There was no dispute throughout the trial that these activists were non-violent. The case was made is that they endangered the security of the aerodrome. And last Monday, the activists were found guilty by jury after, as you say, a 9 week trial. Sentencing takes place on the 4th of February. We do not yet know what that sentence will be, though, as a rough guide, the only time as far as we are aware, that this charge has ever been brought was against a helicopter pilot who deliberately flew his helicopter at the control tower of Coventry Airport a month after the September the 11th attacks. So this was back in 2001, and was sentenced to 3 years in prison. That was commuted to 2 years. There has to be a possibility that there will be custodial sentences for some of the defendants, particularly because many of these defendants are experienced in direct action, and some of them have suspended sentences from previous actions. Though we yet to find out exactly what the sentence is going to be.
Okay, thanks. And so where are the activists now? Are they in custody, or have they got out on bail?
They are free awaiting sentencing. So they're not in custody, and they, in fact, there is no bail to be paid. It's been, accepted that they're not a danger of flight, and they're not violent. So they are out waiting for the sentencing.
Thanks. I mean, it's obviously a torturous situation for those activists to be in. And those who know direct action in Britain, I guess, would expect those initial charges, aggravated trespass and criminal damage, as ones that are commonly applied after direct actions take place, and perhaps the charges that one expects and is willing to take in order to make the protest. Why do you think it was the Crown Prosecution Service's decision to upgrade the charges, is that right? And why do you think they made that decision? They must have explained it during the case.
Well, they didn't. In fact, there is no explanation put forward as to why that happened, and this, in fact, became one of the key demands of the defence team, who said that who demanded a stay of the prosecution, in other words, for the prosecution to be abandoned. And they did this because they argued that there was an abusive process. What happens is that when this charge is brought, the Attorney General has to take a ruling on it. In other words, has to give his or her consent. In fact, it's Geoffrey Cox QC, who people in Britain will be perhaps familiar with at the moment, seeing as he has recently played a key role in contempt of Parliament as part of Theresa May's government. Geoffrey Cox's role in this, the Attorney General's role in this, is to protect defendants from inconsistent or excessive charging. He has not given his reasons why he allowed this charge to go forward. It seems strange, to say the least. That if the role of the Attorney General is to protect defendants from inconsistent charging, that he would have thought this charge was an appropriate one to bring, given that in July 2015, 13 activists broke into Heathrow by cutting through the fence and constructed a tripod on the runway. And in September 2016, a group of nine activists crossed the River Thames in a rubber dinghy, like something out of a Frederick Forsyth novel, made their way onto the runway at London City Airport and constructed a tripod, and disrupted the airport for a number of hours. In both those cases, the defendants were charged with aggravated trespass, tried at a magistrate's court. In other words, the trial would last a few hours. On a single day, there would be no jury, and on both cases, they got non-custodial sentences. In fact, it was a conditional discharge for the nine activists for the London City action, and a number of the activists got suspended sentences for the Heathrow 13 action. And therefore, there's a clear inconsistency in charging here. One of the key issues which came up was whether the activists had endangered the security of the aerodrome by moving beyond the Titan Airways aeroplane into the darkness and potentially onto the runway. And the runway was closed for about 80 minutes on the night that the action took place. And it was the prosecution's case that the defendants endangered the security of the airport, even if they didn't go onto the runway. Well, in these two previous actions, the defendants had clearly gone onto the runway. They were not accused of endangering the security of an airport. So there's an inconsistency in charging here. We have to think about why, in this case, the Crown Prosecution Service and the Attorney General agreed that this kind of escalation of charging was appropriate. There's no reason given during the trial as to why that was. We can perhaps speculate. We can speculate that in previous cases, activists were acting as environmental activists, and they were protesting about climate change. In this case, the activists weren't doing that. Now, there are activists who, from a coalition of groups, End deportations, lesbians and gays support the migrants, and plain stupid. Many of the activists had a background in environmental activism. In fact, one of the activists who represented herself was one of the leaders of the campaign against Take Britain's sponsorship by BP. They were acting in this case not to protest about climate change, but to stop a deportation flight. In other words, they were directly challenging the Home Office's policy of detention and deportation and its right to manage the UK's borders in an exclusionary way. I think one can perhaps draw a line between the Home Office's policies, the challenge to those policies, and the charges that were brought against these activists on this occasion.
Okay, so your speculation is that ultimately the politics matters. The content and the politics of the action seems to be what explains that difference in charging between this case and the previous climate-related cases. I suppose the way that politics sometimes comes into the trials is around the lawful excuse defence, where some direct activists have been able to argue that in stopping a greater crime, their criminal activity in cutting fences or causing disruption was justified. Now, was that attempted here, that defence?
Yes, that's a really interesting point. From the start, I think from the moment that the activists were arrested, so prior to the action, the activists were very clear that they were acting to stop named and unnamed people being deported in a way which they argued very strongly, knowing some of the cases, which would leave these people open to persecution in the places in sub-Saharan Africa to which they were going to be deported. There were a number of cases discussed by the defendants in court, particularly about people who were gay. There's one case of a lesbian woman in particular, and that the persecution that she would be subjected to on arrival in Nigeria. What's interesting about the case is that throughout the case, the judge found conservatively. He continually and consistently found with the prosecution and against the defence in legal argument. And there was a lot of legal argument in the case. The case lasted 9 weeks. The jury could only have been present for about half that time. But the judge nonetheless allowed the defence to make a justification case. In other words, a large part of the evidence was about the motivations of the activists. Now, they argued that they were acting to prevent a greater harm, and they explained this to the jury in ways which I think were quite simple and quite straightforward. The prosecution clearly challenged this, and the judge did a split summing up, a split ruling. In the first part of the ruling, he ruled that justification could not be decided on by the jury. In other words, having had the evidence presented to the jury, he said that the jury may not find on cases of justification. So it's quite interesting in the sense that we could hear the arguments, but the jury was not allowed to find on those arguments. It could not consider them. The judge has not explained why justification. He still hasn't explained why. I was in touch, in fact, with one of the defence barristers this morning, and the defence barrister said that they still have not had an explanation or a rationale from the judge to explain why justification could not be put forward. I think, again, we can look at this and say, well, if defendants cannot make a justification argument, even where they have clearly signalled right from the start, right from the moment after they were arrested. So in their statements to police on arrest, many of them spoke about their reasons for doing this and spoke about specific cases. If defendants cannot make a justification argument, then I think we need to start thinking about what sorts of arguments activists can put in court and how that might affect their strategies. clearly making this kind of action at an airport means that that is the last possible moment at which they could act within the deportation process. And that seems to fit into a necessity defense, which says that one acts to stop imminent harm. And this would be the last moment in Britain that you could act to stop someone that you reasonably felt was at imminent harm, because it would be outside of your remit once the plane had taken off. But the prosecution argued, well, what does imminent harm mean? Were they at harm, risk of serious harm in the plane? Would they be at risk of significant harm in the airport where they arrived in Nigeria? And therefore, they challenged the idea of imminent, and they challenged the idea that the defendants might know that harm was definitely going to take place. And so they ruled out a justification, and the judge clearly must have found with the prosecution and ruled out a justification defense.
So often the lawful defense works with a magistrate, doesn't it? So there is no jury to consider that. And for a magistrate, it's a bit more straightforward for them to consider multiple issues at the same time in passing a judgment, whereas as I understand it, in a jury trial, the judge has to give the jury a very clear task to make a decision on, and there is a difficulty there, isn't there, about kind of having multiple issues to make a decision on. So in most cases the decision is guilty or innocent, although there are some trials where juries are used to decide on matters of fact, but usually it's a case of guilt or innocence. Do you know of cases where lawful excuse has been used successfully with a jury?
Yes, absolutely. So, and in 10 years ago, in fact, King's North in 2008, you remember the year before, a group of Greenpeace activists scaled the chimney at King's North Power Station in Kent. There were six of them. They were taken to court. I think it was criminal damage that they were charged with. And criminal damage, once it's over £5,000, you can get up for a jury trial. And they were accused of having committed £30,000 worth of criminal damage by scaling a chimney at the power station from the inside, going onto the tower, and then scaling down the outside of it. And they were going to write Gordon Binnett, but they didn't get all the way down. They just managed to write Gordon after Gordon Brown, the Prime Minister at the time. They went to a jury trial at King's North. The defence were allowed to present what was loosely termed as expert witnesses, including James Hansen, Zach Goldsmith, whose reputation was perhaps somewhat higher 10 years ago than it is today, and several others. And the jury found that they had acted to prevent the committal of a greater crime, the greater crime being climate change. It's very unlikely that let's call that a very expansive understanding of what justification might be. And over the last 10 years, a number of activists have tried to present justification defences. I think at Leeds Crown Court, the Drax protesters who had stopped a coal train from going to Drax Power Station tried to present a justification case and were prevented from doing so by the judge, who unlike in this case, did not allow them even to explain their motivations for doing what they did. So there is perhaps a degree of liberty that judges have in allowing or not allowing a justification defence to be presented. But over the last 10 years, I think the trend certainly is to outlawing justification cases, or at least narrowing the basis on which one might put forward a justification defence, and a jury might be allowed to decide that way.
Okay, good. I mean, I think that raises a really important question, a kind of broader question, which is how you see this specific case fitting into wider trends around the trials of protesters, whether it is a one-off or whether it seems to be an indication of a growing repression.
Okay, so I think there's perhaps three points to make. And I think the first one is I would come back to the idea around deportation. And I think in this case, there does seem to be a sense where this is a special case, that this is, it's hard to add any kind of sense of political unity to decision making within the criminal justice system, because it is so polycentric. There are so many different decision makers at so many different levels. But I think it is very clear that this charge, or listen, I do not think it's a coincidence that this charge has been brought to forestall any possibility of protesting directly against a deportation flight. And I think more widely than that, because this Aviation and Maritime Security Act 1990 is being used, this means specifically that protests at airports fall under this act. And one of the most worrying features, I think, about this case was one of the prosecution's arguments that because the police had to attend to this action, they would not have been able to attend to a different action happening at the same time by persons unknown elsewhere at the airport. So it's a kind of a what we would call a secondary endangerment. In other words, that the activists were not just responsible for their own actions, they were also responsible for what other people might have done at the same time. And in this sense, they used the threat of terrorism and the idea that the terrorist threat was critical at the time, was central in the prosecution's argument, to say that the activists had endangered the airport. So this, in effect, creates or potentially creates airports as spaces of democratic suspension, which I think brings to the second point, which is that, you know, for the last 10 years, we've been living a politics of austerity since the global financial crash. And I would argue certainly that government policies erected social inequality and social exclusion as conscious goals of what government should do. And I think under those cases, under those situations, we've seen, austerity is in fact, in the piece that I argued in Social Movement Studies last year, austerity is not just a political project and it's not just an economic project. It's also a project about reducing civic space, about reducing the possibility of citizens to act publicly and to claim a different type of politics. And it seems to me that this also fits into those evacuations of democratic space, that there are now some spaces, if this prosecution is a good yardstick, which become out of bounds for democratic contest. And I think the third argument that I'd make about this is that there is a certainly developing trend that we've seen in the fracking case. And I think it's important to think that there was a win in the High Court in October with the three Preston New Road fracking activists who were imprisoned at the end of September at Preston Crown Court, and how this was brought to the High Court, and the three activists were freed in the High Court. Well, there is also a sense there that they weren't freed just because they were imprisoned, but because they had good character. The written ruling stresses that the good character of those defendants should have been brought into play, rather than simply that one cannot, because of the terms of the European Convention on Human Rights, imprison non-violent activists. And there does seem to be a wider sense in Britain at the moment. We've had the SPICOPS inquiry, which is still ongoing, about the infiltration of non-violent activist groups by the Metropolitan Police officers. We've seen the increased use of injunctions. We've seen this escalation in charging. And I think it's possible also to think about an escalation in sentencing. And there does seem to be, in particular, for non-violent but disruptive protest. I think also of the recent article by Joanne Gilmore and collaborators in Critical Policy Studies about Barton Moss, the policing of Barton Moss fracking, about David Mead's recent article about civil rights and protest under the coalition government. There does seem to be a developing trend, a developing chill towards disruptive protest in Britain. And I think those three things together perhaps start maybe thinking, I think you could add into that also the fact that if disruptive activists cannot claim justification, as seems increasingly to be the case, that it's becoming increasingly difficult to have that physical embodied disruptive protest in Britain.
Okay. Thanks. It's a really fascinating and somewhat depressing picture.
Yeah,
to return to the Standard of 15, then presumably they have a right of appeal at some point. Do you know when that right can be exercised? Do they need to wait for sentencing, or is it likely to go in before then?
They've got to wait till sentencing. So right. Sentencing is on the 4th of February at Chelmsford, Chelmsford Crown Court. Presumably it will be at 10 a.m. I'm expecting there to be a large demonstration there. I think that the defendants would probably be very pleased to see a lot of people there outside the court and in the public gallery. The public gallery has been more or less packed throughout the whole 9 weeks of the trial, in fact. And on the during the judges summing up, there weren't enough seats for everybody who was there to sit there. So the 4th of February, there will be sentencing. I would expect there to be an appeal almost immediately thereafter. And the appeal against the Frack Free 3 from Preston was heard within 3 weeks. I would expect there to be a similar speed about the hearing of the appeal if the activists are sent to prison. And I do think that at least some of the activists are probably facing a custodial sentence.
Right, okay. So we obviously can't prejudge what the appeal is likely to look like or its chances of success right now. There are clearly issues around human rights where the Human Rights Act might be brought into play. But I guess we'll have to wait and see what the specifics are then. In the meantime, is there anything you think people can do to support the Stansted 15?
Turn up to Chelmsford on the 4th of February, I think. Get in touch with ND Deportations. They are widely available on Twitter. There are a number of support activities going on, particularly in London. At the moment, there was a rally outside the Home Office on Tuesday at 5 o'clock. I'm sure there will be a number of other actions. And there are a number of letters which are going into different newspapers at the moment. If you're a member of UCU, there is that's the Academic University and Colleges Union. There is a letter, a UCU letter. I know there's a letter going into the Financial Times tomorrow, which you might have seen on Twitter. There are all sorts of different support organizations and support rallies that are available to people if they want to get involved. And certainly, if you go to the End Deportations website, there will be a running agenda of different actions. And they are also asking for money for support. I think it's been very difficult for a number of the defendants. It's not just been a 9 week trial. They were originally due to go to trial on the 1st of March. The trial was started and then postponed. They've effectively had their lives put on hold for the last 18 months. It's been difficult for them. I think none of them live in Chelmsford. They've had to live with, get rooms in houses from local networks, particularly the Quakers. In Chelmsford have been very present in providing support networks. We know of people who've been coming from as far away as Ipswich to bring food for them for lunch. I think it's been very difficult. It's been quite expensive. And therefore raising money for a future legal appeal. The lawyers have been working pro bono, but nonetheless, raising money for a future legal appeal, and for the campaign in general, I think would be very, very useful.
Okay, thank you. Thanks very much for your time, Graham. It's fascinating and insightful stuff. And it is obviously part of a wider scholarly project. So we look forward to seeing publications come out of that in the near future.
Okay, thank you.
Pleasure.